The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 15th, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk to you, as always, about MotoGP and motorcycles and good stuff in general. I said exciting. It may not necessarily always be a very exciting show, I have to admit. It's a little bit like the NPR of motorsport, but it is always interesting, informative, and insightful. So we've got that going for us. And actually, today's show is kind of exciting because we have a really cool call coming up here in a little while with David Podolsky of Chicken Hawk Racing. They make tire warmers. So we're talking about tires, not just tire warmers, but tires and how tire warmers can affect those and all sorts of things. And it's a good call. We talked a lot about a variety of different things, how this relates to racing, how it relates to track days, because I know the track day thing has been very, very popular. That sort of turned into a much more than I ever thought it was going to be about me talking about track days and all that sort of thing. A whole lot of interest. So I know you guys are interested in there out there about it. I'm trying not to shift the focus of the show completely to track days and all that sort of thing. We are still a MotoGP show and AMA and World Superbike and all that good stuff. But, you know, it's a little bit that, you know, some other topics once in a while. So that's a good call. That's coming up here in a little while. Before we get to that, first thing we got to do, big shout out. Thank you to Joseph Celeo, who was kind enough to donate to MotoGPOD, help pay for the bandwidth and all that sort of good stuff. Do really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Joseph. You're a good guy, and thanks for supporting the show. And I have to admit, I with those donations, the last thing that I purchased was a rear stand for my new track bike, because as I told you last week, I bought an SV650, and it's a track bike. It's all race prepped and everything else, but I had no track stand, no rear stand for that thing, and so it's leaning against a workbench right now. It's kind of lame, so I needed a rear stand, so I went ahead and found one. Got one on eBay, good deal on one, and I've got that coming here shortly. So that's one thing that your donations go to help, and I'll admit, you know, it's a lot of it does pay for the bandwidth and all that sort of thing, but I've got like a year's worth of hosting in the bank and a lot of other things going on, so some of these donations are being diverted to other purposes, but it does in one way or another affect the show no matter what. All right, enough about the donations. Let's see. Let's talk about a few of the other topics we got going on. I did mention, and a lot of you have emailed, thank you very, very much, that my son has he's gone off to boot camp. He is in the Marine Corps now, and he's in boot camp. He's in his third week, second actual week of training, third week down there. And what he did today was some interesting stuff, and I might talk a little bit about that more at the end of the show, but since that's not a motorcycle sort of a thing, it's kind of a military thing, which is close to my heart, and apparently also a lot of you sort of appreciate stuff. I might talk about that at the end of the show. Between now and then, before we get to our call here with David, why don't we go through some of the emails that I received. Again, thank you very much for all the emails I get. I get a lot of email. Email address is bob@motogpod.com. I always appreciate it. I always try to answer them all and always get to them. And one thing, actually mentioning that, one email that I sent to a listener, it bounced. And it was Peter Vincent. So Peter was talking about track bike stuff. He says, you mentioned changing the shift linkage back to the road pattern. He says, if possible, leave it at the race pattern. He says, well, or why? Well, very good reasons. He says, shifting up, it's far easier to push down on the shifter while you're tucked in behind the screen. When cranked over fully in a left-hand turn, like a left-hander after MG corner at Phillip Island, you cannot get your foot under the lever using a road pattern where you normally shift up to upshift. So you have to short shift off the power or over rev the bike, which is not good for the motor. Either way, you lose time. Race pattern is no worries. When cranked over in a sweeper, pushing down for the next gear keeps the bike settled. The way your body works in a road pattern will upset the handling of the bike, and you will lose time. He says, then shifting down, generally you're on the brakes and sitting up, so the forward momentum makes it easier to go back through the box. He because it only took me one race day to be able to do this subconsciously. I did blow it going down the straight, but two strokes are good. After that, it was all good. So I don't know. I mean, and I knew this on a subconscious level. I knew this is why typical race bikes are set up with a race pattern shift. But I'm still not 100% convinced that I want to risk the chance of going in and hitting that upshift and you know, actually downshifting. So I'm going to think about it a little bit, ride the bike around the block a couple of times. We'll sort of see where we're at. And I might keep it on a race pattern, might keep it on a road pattern. Either way, it's not like it's all that difficult to switch back and forth one way or the other. So thank you very much, Peter. Like I said, I sent you an email back. It bounced. So I don't know what happened on the email address there, but one way or the other, it wasn't working. But I do appreciate the email a lot. Moving on, other emails we got. Let's see. Last week, Jules and I, on our conversation, we talked about the number of champions that we have going on this year's MotoGP grid. And you remember, we got 18 riders so far. And we, Jules and I, said that there were 10 of them that were actual champions in World Superbike or one of the various classes of MotoGP, world champions. These are just basically what we're talking about. It was the huge depth of the grid this year. Well, apparently we might have miscounted, a little bit of a miscalculation, because among other emails, I got one from Clifford Jones in Australia. So many Australian listeners emailing us all the time. Come on, you American guys, you need to catch up. There's only a lot less people in Australia, but I get a lot of email out of Australia. Well, in any event, Clifford sent us an email. He says, great podcast this week. Really enjoyed it. Have fun with your SV650, blah, blah, blah. I listened to Jules' comment about the champions in MotoGP this year. He says, I count 11. Casey Stoner, Valentino Rossi, Nicky Hayden, Danny Pedrosa in 125 and 250 GP, Andre Dovizioso in 125 GP, Christopher Mullen, World Supersport Champion 2003, Marco Melandri 250s, Jorge Lorenzo 250s, James Toland World Superbike, Loris Caparossi 250s, and Colin Edwards World Superbike. So apparently, I think the one, without going back and listening to the whole show, I think the one that we missed was Christopher Mullen. So Jules and I are shamefaced. Thank you very much, Clifford, for bringing that to attention. That brings our total to 11, so it makes it even better and sort of more cogent and timely. 11 out of 18 of the guys that are currently going to be on the grid next year for MotoGP are world champions in either World Superbike or one of the various classes of MotoGP. That's stupendous. I mean, these guys are huge. You know, the depth of the field, like I said, is really super impressive. So thank you very much, Clifford, for bringing that to our attention. Do appreciate it. Next little item that we got going on, this is about, we talked several shows ago, we've been talking about this one for a while, the Barry Sheen documentary that was showing on the Biography Channel in just about every country in the world except the United States, because apparently nobody in America cares about a really, really cool guy. So I said last week the Barry Sheen Legacy DVD was available, and I said that I had only found it in PAL. Well, Brian Worthing sent me an email. He said that he found it in NTSC. So if you're in the United States and you'd like to get a DVD in the NTSC format so that you can watch it on your regular DVD player rather than having to watch it on your computer or whatever, he says he found it on Amazon Marketplace. He grabbed up one of them. But if not, I will post the link. So if you go to Amazon.com and you search for Legacy, Personal History of Barry Sheen, then you will find it. And there's a couple of copies there that are listed as being NTSC. I asked Brian to send me an update on that, if the DVD that he receives is actually truly NTSC. But either way, no matter what, if you have to watch it in PAL on your computer, this is still well worth watching. And if you get an NTSC, so it's a regular old DVD that you can watch and sit there in the TV and have a beer and all that good stuff, then that's good too. All right, let's see. Next little topic that we got going on, and this one's kind of a sad one. Richard Erickson sent me a message, and yet again, another Australian listener. And Richard says, g'day. With the news announced this week that Dorna are not going to renew Mark Brax's contract. Now, this is where I heard this from when Richard sent me the email about it, that Mark Brax was not going to get his contract renewed. If you don't know who Mark Brax is off the top of your head, he's the Pit Lane Reporter. So for the last couple of years that we've had the MotoGP feed, if you watch it on Speed TV or if you watch it on MotoGP.com, the announcer that you hear is Nick Harris and Gavin Emmett up in the booth, and Mark Brax down there on pit lane. And Mark Brax is the Australian guy. His accent is totally different if you listen carefully. And he's the guy that's running up and down pit lane, talking to the mechanics and the racers and whatnot that down there, right there on the track in the garage. And apparently his contract is not going to be renewed. So Richard continuing says that Mark Brax's contract to be the pit lane reporter will not be renewed. But Richard has started a petition to send to Dorna to let them know how much the public likes having Braxy as a pit lane reporter. And the petition can be found, and the link is savebraxy-petition.clubeasy.com, which of course I will post this link on the website. So just go to motogpod.com, find the link of Save Braxy, and sign this petition. He says, Richard continues that with only a few weeks left until the season start, there isn't a lot of time to collect signatures on the petition, so any help that we all, MotoGPOD listeners, can give will be much appreciated, and it definitely is. Go ahead and go and sign up. Sign on this petition. Tell them that you want Mark Brax to continue as the pit lane reporter, because from what I understand from a few other things that I've heard from the Duke over at the podcast there, this is a political sort of a thing. There's some sort of internal infighting going on of, you know, somebody just can't get along with Brax, and so the guy's out of a job. And this is not good, because if you remember, if you've been watching MotoGP on Speed Channel or on MotoGP.com, if you've been watching it for a few years, back in 2005, Nick Harris, who is the older sounding voice that you hear on MotoGP, was the pit lane reporter that year. And we had one guy up in the booth, and I believe it was Gavin Emmett, but it might have been Matthew Roberts at that time. I can't remember which one it was. One guy up in the booth, and then Nick Harris running up and down pit lane, as well as trying to interview the riders from the 125s and the 250s and all of that in the podium interviews and all that, and trying to be the color guy, and trying to do all this other stuff, and it was just a freaking train wreck. They need three people. You need two guys up in the booth, you need a play-by-play and a color guy, and then you need somebody down in pit lane. And good commentary can make or break whether a race is enjoyable to watch. I know there are people out there, there's actually quite a few people out there, that kind of like to watch the race with no commentary whatsoever. But I think that the vast majority of us enjoy the race more with a good commentary. And what we've had in MotoGP has been pretty darn good the past few years. When you watch it on Speed or you see it on MotoGP.com, if you're lucky enough to see it on Eurosport, you're getting the cream of the crop as far as commentary is concerned. But just imagine if Randy Mamola was gone. So, and that's what we're facing for those of us that can't get the Eurosport feed. We're going to lose our pit lane reporter, and it's just going to be a big disaster. And one example I can give of how much commentary will affect whether or not a race is worth watching or not is Formula One. The sport of Formula One is honestly about as exciting to watch as watching grass grow. But the fact that here in the United States we have Bob Varsha, Steve Matchett, and David Hobbs in the commentary booth, they are such an excellent team that they make the sport exciting. So picture if Peter Windsor, who is the pit lane reporter for Formula One, was gone. That's the same thing with Mark Braxy being gone. So we need Brax back, and we want him to keep his job because he's got the passion. He has the right attitude. He has this sort of sense of, I don't know, it's almost a sense of appreciation. And Brax has been on the show before. I've talked to Mark Brax here on the show. He's a great guy. He's a very, very gracious man. Like I said, he appreciates the fact that he's getting to do this pit lane job. He's not some sort of prima donna or anything like that. He's a professional guy that does a professional job, but also realizes how lucky he is to have such a job, and he deserves this job. So let's go to the website that I'm going to put on MotoGPOD.com. The link will be up there. And let's sign the petition at clubeasy.com and see if we can do anything to influence that and get Brax back on the crew. So, like I said, there's a little bit of a downer note. But moving on. And last email that I'm going to read today, this is another good one. And this is from a New Zealand listener, so another Down Under listener from New Zealand. And it's David, unfortunately, David Neal. David and I do have a last name. And this one is kind of interesting because it's a little bit of a question, as though Bob Hayes here is knowledgeable about stuff. But I was able to point David in the right direction on this one, I think at least. So I'm going to read the email. He says, hi, Bob. He says, I'm frustrated. My GSXR 1000 manual is useless, and the workshop manual is useless for suspension advice. He says, I'm 105 kilograms, which is, I don't know, over 200 pounds, and I want to adjust my suspension. Do you know of any good books? I want something simple, like if such and such is occurring, you go two clicks up on the rebound damping or two clicks off of the fork damping, et cetera, et cetera. He says, maybe things are not this simple, but I just really want to know what each suspension adjustment item controls and how it affects things, i.e., what can you expect to occur when you tweak adjuster X? He says, armed with this, I can hopefully experiment. And David, this is why we call it a black art. It is like that. And I mean, I know to a point what the suspension adjustments do. I'm probably going to get called out on this one, but your prebound basically pre-compresses the suspension, so it makes it a little bit stiffer because you're smashing up the springs. Like I said, this is oversimplification, and I'm going to guide you guys in the right direction, but here real quick, here's the Bob Hayes version of what's going on with your suspension. And basically the Bob Hayes version is you take $40 and you go to the suspension expert at the track day and have him do it. But prebound somewhat shortens up the suspension. Rebound compression slows down the tire or wheel or the suspension opening up after it has compressed. So you hit a bump in the road, your suspension compresses. Rebound compression is what slows it down as far as extending back out, because you don't want it to just sort of jackhammer back out. It has to go out, you know, at some sort of a controlled rate. And compression damping slows that up as you hit the hole or bump. And your compression tries to, or your suspension, excuse me, tries to compress. Compression damping slows that. So basically, this, in a nutshell, what you want to adjust to get what feeling? I really honestly have no idea. Like I said, I take $40, I go to this track guy and have him do it, which last time I did it was Dave Moss. So what I sent to David as advice is, I know of two DVDs, and I'm sure there's a lot more out there, and I'm sure there's a lot of books out there that simplify this stuff, but the two DVDs that came to the top of my head of Suspension for Mere Mortals, which is actually what one of them is called, are from Traction Dynamics, and this is Max McAllister, who's been on the show before. He's a suspension expert over there on the East Coast in the United States. Traction with two X's, and he makes a DVD called Suspension for Mere Mortals, and he's at traction.com. And then Dave Moss over there at Catalyst Reaction, who's on the West Coast. And like I said, I've actually met Dave, super nice guy, and just gave me, a fantastic deal for my money of adjusting my suspension there at my track day. And he also happens to have a couple of DVDs, and he participates in some forums and things like that. And his website is at feelthetrack.com. Feelthetrack.com. That's Catalyst Reaction Suspension Tuning by Dave Moss. So you check out either of those DVDs. I'm sure you're going to be happy. You're going to learn a lot, and you get to sort of twiddle with some knobs and try it. And basically, it does boil down to taking lots of test rides, going out there and working the suspension to a point and sort of seeing, oh, this feels different. Oh, you know, that feels different. But I still personally feel that the idea of the suspension expert, if you can go on a track day, you find that suspension expert, which there's almost every track day is going to have one or the other of them. You go to that guy and you spend a few bucks and you have him tweak and tune your suspension right there at the track day, and it's going to be good stuff. We are diverging, going back to our track day lectures. So for those of you who don't do track days, maybe find out your local motorcycle shop. You should hopefully live in a town where there are at least a couple motorcycle shops to find to choose from. So find the one that has the better sort of suspension expert, which after you talk to them for a little bit, I think you'll figure out which one it is and see if they can help you out. You need to adjust your static sag. You need to adjust a few other things to get that bike set up for your weight and, to a certain point, your riding style. So hope that helps a little bit there, David. Do appreciate the question. And I think that about kind of covers it. My limited knowledge of suspension tuning, which frankly is extraordinarily limited. So I think we've done enough blathering on for today. Oh, wait, one more thing. And this I do want to mention. We did have one more email, and this one was from Jason Hegener. And Jason originally sent me an email. He says, I was perusing twistingasphalt.com, and I noticed a blog post. The author mentions an upcoming documentary called Twist the Throttle. And Twist the Throttle is a documentary, a sport biker sort of documentary. It's going to hopefully show up on Discovery Channel. And quoting from the blog, he's talking about going for a motorcycle ride. And he says, to say this was a much-needed break is a bit of an understatement. He says, earlier in the week, after months of plugging away in the editing suite, video editing suite, we delivered the final master tapes for the sport bike project that we've been working on for Discovery Channel called Twist the Throttle. When I have release dates, I will post something more substantial. Bottom line is that it's a fantastic project, the likes of which I've never had the pleasure of working my way through. It's 4 hours of beautiful, high-definition sport bike content reaching around the globe and goes inside eight of the major motorcycle brands. It's covering their amazing histories, factories, latest, greatest sport bikes, blah, blah, blah. It sounds very, very interesting, and we're hoping Discovery Channel will show it in the United States, because the first thing I thought is that, oh, yeah, great. You know, you're going to get that on Discovery Channel Romania, Discovery Channel Poland, Discovery Channel Kazakhstan, but you won't get it on Discovery Channel in the United States. So we'll have to see. I'm hoping that it will come out, because one thing that Jason pointed out is that the MotoCiz documentary on the Discovery Channel in the United States is a sure thing, at least according to the MotoCiz website, and that's at March 25th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. They're going to have a little documentary about MotoCiz. So maybe Discovery is discovering that there's more to motorcycles than simply, you know, the American chopper kind of routine. And this might be possibly what they're finding, is that sport bike riders are a good demographic. We are tend to be, you know, youngish. I mean, I'm 41 years old, but, you know, you're only as old as you feel, right? Youngish. And we have some money to spend, and we are loyal, and we like to spend our money on motorcycle-y type stuff and all that kind of good stuff. We're a good demographic to chase after. So I'm more than willing to support the companies that support my chosen hobby, sport, passion, whatever you want to call it, that sort of thing. And I think that you are too. So hopefully Discovery Channel has realized that. All right. So there we go. We're done with the email. Let's go ahead and move on. Let's go on to our call with David Podolsky. All right. We got David Podolsky on the phone. David is the founder of Chicken Hawk Racing Tire Warmers, company that makes tire warmers. So hi, how you doing, David?
I'm great. How are you today, Bob?
Doing great myself. Thanks very much. First of all, why don't we talk a little bit about Chicken Hawk? What do you guys do? How long you been in business? Just give us a little bit of a plug there.
Well, Chicken Hawk Racing, we started making tire warmers in 1992, and now our company has grown to where we make tire warmers for all different types of motorsports, even though we'd started in road racing motorcycles. We're involved in everything from NASCAR, champ cars, go-karts, and even motorcycle flat track and drag racing. So in this last 15 years, you know, our focus is tire warmers. So, of course, our focus has really been on understanding the variety of circumstances that race tires get put through.
All right. And hopefully today we're going to learn a little bit about exactly what that is, what happens to that tire when we're doing stuff. So I've read a couple of the articles that you wrote. There's some good stuff. You had one here in Road Racing World, and also the other one here was what was this other magazine here? It unfortunately got cut off. But two great articles talking about tire warmers and tires in general. And this is something, you know, we sort of think, I mean, tires are one of my favorite subjects, because I think with tires and suspension, these are the two things that any motorcycle rider, particularly a beginning to intermediate motorcycle rider, if you make changes there, you will notice it. You know what I'm saying? It's not like that extra 2 horsepower is that you got because you put on a very expensive exhaust is going to make that much difference compared to what you're going to feel from a new set of tires or a suspension. And I'm pretty sure you agree with some like that kind of statement.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the thing is with a tire, and just like when you get any production bike, you know, it's built for the vast different types of circumstances that it's going to be encountering. So a production bike isn't designed specifically to go racing. And when you want to try to change it, you know, that whether it's suspension changes and gearing changes and even geometry changes, it makes a big difference. And certainly the tires that come on your bike, as on your street bike, really aren't race tires either. They're sport tires, but they're meant to last a long time and not to be burned up in a day or in a weekend like a race tire would.
Right. Now, talking about tires and what happens to the tire, let's start off super basic. Why would somebody want to use a set of tire warmers? What's so critical about getting that here's a softball kind of question. What's so critical about getting that tire up to temp, and what sort of happens?
I think it's important to understand, you know, why you want a tire warmer. It's kind of important to understand what happens to a race tire. And first of all, as I'm sort of leading to, when you get a street tire, that tire is meant to last for a long time. It's meant to work in the dry. It's meant to work in the wet. It's also meant to work if you hit really big potholes. It's not a race tire. A race tire, on the other hand, is meant to last sometimes just the length of the race, or maybe it's meant to last just for the weekend. And a race tire is going to be with a little bit of a softer carcass a lot of times. It's going to have certainly a different compound on it, and it's designed to work very differently. So when you're out there on a racing vehicle, in our case in a motorcycle, that tire goes through a lot of different types of loads, meaning you're squeezing the brake and crushing the front tire, and it gets deformed. It doesn't have that nice shape that you see when it's mounted on your rim sitting in your garage. And the same thing when you're cornering and accelerating. You're flexing, deforming the tire, and it's constantly coming back to its original shape. And that's really called hysteresis, where the tire flexes and then returns back. And that generates heat. I think maybe a lot of people don't realize how much heat that can generate, but if you're riding hard, meaning in a racing environment, you can find that the carcass of the tire can reach maybe 80 Celsius, or about 175 degrees, is a very common temperature to see. You can see higher than that, but that's a pretty common temperature, which, you know, that's hot. 175 degrees will hurt your hand. And as that tire gets up to temperature, just through its normal usage on the racetrack, it's also going to build up in tire pressure, because you set whatever tire pressure you did, and it was 75 degrees outside, and you just gained 100 degrees out on the track. So the pressure in the tire will also go up considerably. And to give you an idea, Bob, if you started out with 30 pounds at your cold pressure, and your tire went from an ambient to 75 Fahrenheit up to 175 in the carcass of the tire, you'll probably see about a 20% rise and be riding on a 36-pound tire when you get that temperature up to, you know, what we call fully heat-soaked or stable. So you can kind of take a look at it. That's a pretty dramatic change, not only in the rise in temperature, but in terms of the pressure. It sort of leads you down the road to why someone would want a tire warmer.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and on that, are you heating that tire with that tire warmer? Are you getting it up to 175 before it even hits the track, or is there still more warming to do after you go out on the track?
Well, you know, the ideal situation is if you knew from your testing that your tire was going to, and again, we'll use the same numbers, you knew that after your rider came in off the track and he had a 36-pound tire, and he had 175 degrees, and everything was working well with that pressure and temperature, and that's what he's going to end up with at the end of the race, you'd want to emulate that or create that prior to him going out. You'd set your tire warmer at 175. A lot of the pro warmers are digital these days, and they're setting their hot tire pressure on the warmer. So that you'll see that we work with the vast majority of AMA Superbike teams, and every tire has what time the tire warmer started and the pressure they want that tire to be at when it goes on the bike hot. So that if you did a good job, you'll really have very little change in temperature and pressure once he's out on the racetrack.
Okay, interesting. I always thought that tire warmers weren't able to get the tire up to the full temperature. So that is not the case. Then you are able to get it pretty darn close. Then is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, our warmers can get the tires hotter than you'd like. But you know, sometimes even a qualifying tire, there are times where you're seeking a plus 200 degrees or, you know, close to 100 Celsius. So, yeah, you can get the tire carcass very, very hot.
Yeah, like you say, definitely too hot to touch, and at the point where it's actually sticky and will pick up, you know, rocks and debris and whatnot from the track. Yeah,
I mean, I think the pressure is one of the things people don't understand. Of course, the surface, you know, the very exterior of the tire, that's what's grabbing the racetrack. That's what's actually filling the voids in the nooks and crannies of the surface of the track. It's what you call mechanical keying. So that's how the rubber is sort of grabbing the track, aside from its own inherent friction and traction that it has being rubber. But the pressure takes some time to build up. So if you were going to go out on a tire and it was going to go from 30 to 36 pounds, it's going to feel pretty different under heavy braking or heavy cornering loads, and certainly under acceleration. So it's the pressure really does take some time. Being a tire warmer company, people want to understand tires almost even more than our product, so we've focused a lot of attention on how the tires work and what they go through. And some of the things that we've tested is to take a look at taking a tire with ambient temperature, meaning not heated, and taking a fast, accomplished rider and letting him try to bring that tire up to temperature just from using it on the racetrack. And you'll see that even a professional rider will take four, five, six laps in that kind of range before he can get the tire pressure to come up to where it needs to be.
Wow. So this is definitely something that can be a big advantage to get your data all right and set up so that you know that you, on that first lap, you have a tire that's pretty close to your temp.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's kind of funny about that is a lot of the guys that are club racers or track day guys think, well, I'm not a pro. I don't need the tire warmer. But the truth is, if you were to ride around at a snail's pace, you'd never get the tire up to temperature or pressure. So just taking that analogy, the club racer, the track day rider, if the pro needs five laps, he may need eight or more laps to get that tire to fully come up to temperature and fully come to the hot pressure that you desire.
And at that point, at eight laps, you're almost done with a typical sort of track day session on most track day organizations where you go out for like 20 minutes.
No, you're absolutely right.
So now, when the tire is at temp, that's kind of going back to something you mentioned earlier, where we're talking about the mechanical keying. So that tire is actually sort of sinking into the nooks and crannies of the track, in effect, and the rubber is kind of gripping down between the little crevices and whatnot of the asphalt?
Right. If you could imagine, you kind of have two ways to take a look at the traction. Imagine if the tire was on a piece of perfectly smooth glass and you had to slide it. Well, it would have some grip. It wouldn't just slide like a stone across that perfectly smooth glass because the rubber has some friction and traction of its own just due to its compound of being rubber. But the track is not like a piece of glass, and it has nooks and crannies in it, and some tracks are more abrasive than others. And even at speed, yes, the tire does fill those nooks and crannies and kind of fill those voids in the track, and it's what you call mechanical keying, and that's why at some tracks there's better grip than others.
That describes the reason why tracks have grips. I understand that, and I didn't kind of think of it in those terms of the tire actually doing that, but yeah, that's kind of interesting. Now, talking about if you're using a set of tire warmers, and let's think of it in both professional racing terms, where budget is much less of an issue, or possibly maybe if you're really lucky, it's not even an issue at all, right? Or in club racer, track day rider guy terms, how often can you bring these tires up to how many heat cycles can they go through before they start noticeably degrading because of that? And what sort of causes that? Why do tires degrade simply from getting hot and then being cooled down?
Well, it's exactly what I was saying in the beginning. Race tires are not built like street tires. If you looked at your car, for example, you expect to get 50,000 miles out of your tires, or you'd be upset that they wore out too quickly. Obviously, those tires would not be suitable for racing, where they're changing the tires quickly. It's almost like the difference between getting a hard cookie, like a Chips Ahoy cookie, or something out of the oven that's not completely baked and is still chewy. The race tire is not fully vulcanized, meaning it's almost not fully cooked. They understand that because it's going to be at these types of temperatures, the vulcanization process will continue with its use on the track. There's a whole slew of chemicals that go into the tires that the engineers put in there to make the tire have grip. And these are things that are like plasticizers, emulsifiers, elastomers that make the tire more elastic and really give that tire a tremendous amount of grip. but it's also why you see the balls of rubber form on the edge of a tire as it's getting scraped off, because the tire is that soft a compound that, in, for example, in a MotoGP race, that tire really is only designed to last those 25 laps, let's say. They don't want a tire that's going to last 100 laps. They're trying to get the best grip that they can long enough for the race to complete. Those activators get set off and have their reaction when they get heated. And what that happens is they start to move and get migrated up to the surface of the tire and give that tire some grip. It's one of the reasons that after you cool the tire off and you let it cool back down, what happens is the tire will become a little bit harder. Each time you heat it and cool it, the tire will get a little bit harder. If you've not used the tire warmer, if you just went out and used the tire, got it hot, brought it back, let it cool down, when you first come off the track, the tire looks great. But then you come back to it a couple hours later after it's cooled, and usually you see like a blue haze on the surface of the tire. And what that is, it's these moistures migrating up to the surface and oxidizing. And you wish that those chemicals were back in the rubber, because that's what's giving the tire its moisture, its grip, and you know, otherwise it's basically starting to dry out each time you heat it and cool it.
Okay. But what about, say, if you've got the tire warmers there on the bike and for some reason or another that session was canceled or something along those lines, what would sort of be, you know, what kind of tire degradation are you going to start seeing simply from that? Is that something where, okay, if it was just one session, you obviously you're going to leave the tire warmers on until your following session because you don't want it to cool back down, right? If it was maybe not a street tire, but like a dot race where it's a treaded tire or even a slick, is this tire still going to be good, you know, simply from going through, is there a rule of thumb? How many heat cycles? Are you following me? Is that a kind
of a... Yes, I am. I mean, yeah. If you wind up where, and I'll answer your question, a club racer is trying, or a track day rider is trying to work with his budget. So he doesn't want to put on a new tire every time he hits the track, like a lot of these pros are never using a tire more than once. So he wants to try to make sure that he can save and avoid heat cycling the tire because of this issue of aging it. So what he would do is heat up the tire on a tire warmer, use the tire out on the racetrack, come back in, and put the tire warmer back on, and that way he'd try to avoid the heat cycle. In terms of a quick answer, how many heat cycles can you put a tire through before you feel it fall off in performance? That does depend on the brand of tire. It does depend on the compound of tire, but probably almost more importantly, it depends on the rider, whereas the very best pros could feel the tire fell off in just a handful of laps. Most mortals, you know, like you and I, would probably think that it was still just fine. We see a lot of tires after 4 or 5 heat cycles. There's a significant fall off in performance, even for the club racer. Obviously, the professional might have noticed it and been held back as lap time suffered after, you know, a single heat cycle. But you could see most club racers, you know, they're trying to get a full day or perhaps a weekend out of a tire.
Sure, sure. Yeah, because like I said, you know, budget is an issue unless you happen to be lucky enough. And I mean, even at the level of say, MotoGP, now they're limiting the number of tires you can have per race weekend. And so we have heard about these guys having to use used tires for a practice session or what have you. So in that case, if you are in that sort of a situation, again, kind of going back, and I think we're sort of, I might be kind of not getting it, but your best bet is to be keep those tires hot, right?
That's right. I mean, for sure, to be able to keep the tires hot and avoid putting it through heat cycles and let that tire have more life, and it will not go through this hardening process, and you will not have all these chemical activators migrate up to the surface. If you knew for some reason that you had your tire hot and you came back in and off the track, put your warmer on, and you knew I've got 2-3 hours to sit around, an extended period of time. Most of the companies make a temperature-adjustable warmer where you can turn the heat down just low enough that you don't really continue to vulcanize the tire, but so that you could avoid the heat cycle and avoid this process of having the chemicals migrate up to the surface and oxidizing, which is probably a temperature around 130 Fahrenheit, maybe something like 53, 55 Celsius.
Is there some kind of method that you use to determine whether or not a tire is starting to go off? I mean, besides just racers feel? Is there some sort of, you know, a gauge or tool or something that you can use to judge that?
You know, a lot of the people in car racing, you see, use durometers, which is a tool that measures how hard the tire is. You really don't ever see it commonly used in motorcycles. I don't really know why. I think motorcycles, you just don't see the pros using tires. The serious teams are never using tires over and over again. You know, whereas it seems like in a lot of the car racing, you do have those sort of structures. They have to use the same tire throughout the weekend. Even in club racing and motorcycles, if I had a bigger budget than you, I'd use four tires on the weekend, and you might just use one. And so, no, you don't really see it used too much. But, no, most of it really is rider feel, and then it becomes your own experience. You know, as you're asking to try to get a real rule of thumb, and I understand that, one of the things to really kind of grasp is tires are very, very different than each other, meaning a single brand like a Michelin tire will have a few different tires for different purposes, meaning is it a wet condition? Is it can it be suitable in dry and wet? Is it just for dry? What temperature range do they think this is going to work at? And you'll see a tremendous mix in the ingredients between synthetic rubber, natural rubber, carbon black, and silica. It's not as if the recipe changes only a few percent. The recipe can change significantly depending on what they think the environment that tire is going to work in. And as you've seen in MotoGP, that's been Michelin's sort of specialty. They can make a tire work great if they know the weather condition. And when it has been a little bit off, the tires really suffered, whereas you saw Bridgestone, based on their manufacturing, was making tires that had a wider window of temperature range. The tire was working close to its maximum performance.
Right. And then, yeah, exactly. And then you'll find situations where, like, Michelin seems to be, at least last year, we're doing better at making a qualifying tire, which is designed to last one lap, in effect, versus the race tire, where Bridgestone seemed to be beating them out.
That's right. I mean, Michelin really was using a sharpshooter approach and having it be, had to be a bullseye if it was right on target. Whereas Bridgestone, just because of their physical location and how their manufacturing was, needed to bring a tire that was more of a shotgun and was going to handle a wider range. So maybe when Michelin was perfect, they were the better tire. But if they didn't hit that temperature and that weather just right, the tire did fall off and suffer. So I think it's maybe guys look at tires and they look at all different brands, whether it's Pirellis or Dunlops, Michelin's, Bridgestones, and they all look so much the same sitting in the dealership. And maybe they even feel pretty similar. But the recipes are very, very different from those tires. And you'll see different characteristics, not only seat of the pants, but in terms of which ones suffer more when it gets hot and which ones suffer more when they go through heat cycles.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually something that's very difficult for the amateur budget track day race club racer guy of, you know, what tire do I want? Because it's a fairly expensive proposition to just sort of try out a new set of tires. And it's hard to switch brands because you don't know, you know, maybe the characteristics of the Pirelli won't be what I'm looking for compared to the characteristics of the Dunlop that I've been using or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Some of that, I think, once the riders do get familiar with a certain feel, because the tires all do have that different sort of feel to them, that it's hard for them to switch over also. They're comfortable with one type of sensation from the tire. I mean, traditionally, it's always been that Michelin had best edge grip, meaning when the tire was on its edge and the bike was completely leaned over, it had more side grip than anybody else out there. And at least here in the U.S., like in club racing, it was always that when that tire let go, it let go pretty big. It didn't give a whole lot of warning. But you found for the guys who like to spin and slide the rear of the bike, most of those guys were preferring Dunlops because the tire broke loose a little bit easier, with a little bit more warning, and it was something that was a little bit more controllable for them. Obviously, Michelin's been working hard at, you know, improving that here. But, yeah, the tires definitely have different flavors.
Yeah, yeah. Now, why is that more of a function of the shape of the tire, of the shape of the profile, or is it the compounds that they're using that the reasons like the Michelin's are giving you better edge grip?
Well, I'll tell you, I from everything that we see, I believe it's really due to the compound of the tire, but I have to say that that's really just my opinion. I mean, we're very lucky. Here at Chicken Hawk Racing, we build tire warmers that are branded Bridgestone, Michelin, Dunlop, and we even build tire warmers that are branded for KTM motorcycles. So we get access to tire engineers who give us a lot of information because, well, we're building a product that has their name on it that goes on their tires. But to really say for sure why Michelin had that characteristic, I really think it's a question of compound more than tire profile.
Now, it's talking about compounds and profiles and things. A lot of things that we're seeing that even mere mortals like ourselves can now have access to is dual or multi-compound tires, where you've got a different compound in the middle versus the sides and all that sort of thing. Is this something that you take into account with the tire warmers, or how is that handled with a tire warmer?
You know, right now it really doesn't need to be addressed with the tire warmer. I think you'd really we see even in the MotoGP and what we do here with AMA Superbike, people are not doing that, where the very edge of the tire warmer is creating a different temperature because there's a different compound on the edge. The tires do have a window of temperature that they want to be in, and obviously different parts of the tire might generate different temperature. If you came off the track, especially on a, let's take an extreme example like Daytona, sure, you're going to find that left side of the tire got a lot hotter than the right side because it was on the banking. So they'll wind up using a harder compound there. But that way it doesn't wind up, you know, getting destroyed being up on the banking. But that's really an extreme situation. Most of the time with these dual compound tires, the window is still large enough. Let's say the tire might be working at its maximum at 165 degrees up to about 205 degrees. If we make a tire warmer that puts it at 175, it's still comfortably within that window. It's not as if the window is so small that the tire warmer needs to change the temperature right side versus left side.
Interesting. Is that something that you're seeing, though, might change, the stuff that you're hearing from the tire companies or anything along those lines?
I haven't really seen it at this point. I mean, they've asked us to build some special things with some dramatically different temperatures for some specific racetracks, but nothing where they've asked us to build something where, you know, as I said, one side of the warmer is hotter than the other.
Okay. Now, when we're talking about the tire continuing to heat up, or if you're not using tire warmers and when your tire does heat up out there on the track, what is causing the tire to heat up? Is it more the flexing of the carcass, or is it more the friction on the road? You know, why does it get hot in a sort of a physics way?
And you're exactly right. It is a physics situation. Again, if you drove around at a parade lap pace, 10 miles an hour, you'd never get any heat in the tire. So you're going to get heat in the tire by deforming the tire, flexing the tire, letting it come back to its original shape, which is the hysteresis that we discussed. But you also generate heat in the tire from sliding it and spinning it. I'll give you an example. When we first saw Supermoto come out, and we were going to make tire warmers for the KTM Supermoto team, I foolishly said, well, they're very lightweight bikes. They only make a small amount of horsepower. They're not going to be on very big banked turns like a Daytona to generate heat. I thought that if a road race bike was making 180 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe these bikes would be 150, 160. But we were very wrong, because what they're doing is, a lot of times the top riders are not only deforming the tires we described, but they're spinning the rear tire. It's constantly hung up sideways. They're able to push and plow the front tire and slide it sideways across the track. And we've seen a lot of tire temperatures over 200 degrees in Supermoto. Now, if I went around and took a Supermoto bike out and I was a decent rider, but I'm sure I can't make the tire be as hot as, you know, Doug Henry and Jeff Ward and Jürgen Klinsel. Those guys are going to generate a lot more temperature than I would.
Right, simply because they're using the tire more to its limit, and then they're harder on tires. But yeah,
they would be abusing it a lot more. They'd be spinning it more. They'd be sliding it more, pushing it more, braking harder, accelerating harder, just doing everything harder. And really, if you think back, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago, you had Matt Mladen winning the championships before Ben took over, and his two teammates were Aaron Yates and Ben Spies on the same equipment, basically on the Oceaneering Suzukis. No one was having tire failures except Mladen, but Mladen was also in a class by himself and running the fastest lap times, and he was just a lot harder on that rear tire than his teammates.
Right, right. Yeah, I do remember that too. Exactly. He had a couple significant incidents due to that. Huh. You talked a little bit about heating the tires up slowly in some of your articles. What can you tell us kind of about that?
You know, it's rather a complex concept for people to understand. But when you take a tire that would be at, let's say, 75 degrees, because that's the temperature of the day, and you go out and ride hard on the racetrack and get that tire to get up to its operating temperature, and again, let's just use 175 degrees, you're making that delta of 100 Fahrenheit, gaining those 100 degrees, usually pretty quickly on the surface of the tire. And what that really does is it gets all those activators, all those chemicals in the tires, those emulsifiers and plasticizers and elastomers, set off really quickly. And it kind of releases them very quickly. And it kind of spends them or wastes them a little bit more than you wished you would. So what would happen is the life of the tire having maximum grip is actually reduced. So that you'll see, if you took two bikes and one had a warmer and one didn't, and they both went out into the race, the guy who had the warmer, who warmed up the tire over a slow period of time in a controlled manner, if his tire, let's say, would last 25 laps before he felt it fall off in performance, the guy who heated it up on the racetrack would have that tire fall off in performance a few laps ahead of time, because he's just, when he got that tire hot, he spent and discharged a lot of the chemicals in the tire by kind of heat shocking the tire. You know, that kind of what happens. And that's really why, you know, almost any sort of track environment, having a tire warmer makes sense, because sometimes you could see tires, they'll either shred, what we call like a cold tear, or there's a poor graining that happens across the face of the tire. Because as it was making that mechanical keying, grabbing the racetrack, the tire is being stretched, and it gets stretched beyond its limit. And then basically the rubber tears, or is what they call cold tears. And so going out with rubber that's ready to go, that's been brought up to temperature nice and slowly, is really the best way to treat the tire. I mean, tires, they're pretty much a dynamic thing, meaning from the minute they come out of the machine, come out of the mold, those tires are aging. So how you take care of them and how you use them, both in terms of where you store them before you go to the racetrack. I mean, you wouldn't want to leave it baking in the sun in your backyard or freezing in your garage at sub-zero temperatures. Then you certainly want to make sure that you manage that tire well. I mean, that's exactly what you need to do to it, because it is a dynamic thing that it's never constant. You know, if you took a piston and put it in your basement, it wouldn't change. A year later, it would still be a piston. So a year later, your tire really isn't any good if it's been sitting in your basement.
It's going to be a bowling ball, right?
That's right.
But, okay, so that addresses, like, the difference between using a tire warmer and the heating the tire up on the track. But what about using a tire warmer where you have luxury of taking, you know, X number of minutes or hours to warm it up versus the, oh, my gosh, all of a sudden I've got to get this tire up as quickly as possible? What's going to be sort of the differences on that?
If you had to get it up to temperature as quickly as possible out on the racetrack?
No, quickly as possible using a warmer.
Well, I mean, when you put a tire warmer on, and we're very careful about deciding how quickly that tire warmer gets hot, we do see some tire warmers that we feel get too hot too quickly, basically, and they also can get the activators and the tires set off too quickly. You'd really like to take the tire warmer and bring it up to temperature slowly. Our tire warmers really only come to its maximum temperature after about 20 minutes, but that doesn't mean the tire is really ready to hit the track. You want to give it probably closer to 45 minutes to an hour so that the heat gets to soak all the way into the tire and it becomes what we call heat soaked or stable, and that's when you've obtained that hot tire pressure with the warmer.
Okay.
So you really need to give yourself that time. You can't really rush that process on the tire warmer.
Interesting. Yeah, so you do in about an hour, if you figure 45 minutes to an hour is going to be a good amount of time, huh? Talking about the tire warmers again, what exactly is inside that sort of little blanket that we see? What makes it hot? How compare it to, say, I don't know, an electric blanket? You know, what do you do to make it hot?
I mean, it is. It's a sophisticated, sort of specialized electric blanket, and what you'll see most of them have is a heating element that's based with some sort of metal alloy. Again, we've worked really hard at perfecting our alloy so that it will heat up slowly, not come up to temperature too quickly, which we think is bad for sort of heat shocking the surface of the tire. And you want to make sure it's something that's going to be flexible. Boy, tire warmers get kicked around and rolled up and run over, and you want to make sure that you've really chosen a good resilient alloy to make that heating element. But we also wind up having things you see in car racing. There'll be Nomex inside, high-temperature Nomex for insulation. There'll also be a Kevlar inside that to give it some strength. And really, you'll have a strong exterior, something that we use a DuPont Cadora to make sure it doesn't tear. And then it's the temperature control. And temperature control is really important. I mean, you want to make sure that the thing is, you're not in a laboratory, but you want to make sure that the tire warmer is going to be accurate in terms of its temperature so that you're obtaining the target that you want. So really, it's the heating element itself. It's having a good insulation that's going to drive the heat into the tire, because if more of the heat escapes into the atmosphere, you're not going to get that tire heat soaked. You're not going to obtain that hot tire pressure. And you want to make sure that you've got a good, strong, easy-to-use casing or carcass of the thing, because they really do get through a lot of abuse in the paddock.
So, and now you're all your tire warmers are all digitally controlled, correct?
Well, really, we started out with a single temperature model that has it's a thermostatic controlled unit, and there's just one temperature, and that's what it does. It comes up to that temperature and maintains it all day. And then we made a digital warmer, and a lot of the professional teams were using that. And it's nice because it has a display to tell you what the surface of the tire is. And it works in Fahrenheit and Celsius, which is nice because so many of the tire companies think in Celsius. But then we saw we had a need to make a temperature-adjustable warmer for the privateer, for the guy who maybe didn't know or the difference between 170 and 180. He just wanted to be able to get the tire hot, but he also wanted to save heat cycles. He also wanted to be able to turn the tire warmer down to a lower temperature, either in between his track sessions for a dry day to save the heat cycles or to heat up a rain tire. A lot of guys are, the rain tires get warm too. They obviously don't get as warm as a tire would in the dry, but there's no reason to go out on a cold rain tire, and especially one that has not yet come up to hot pressure. So we made a model that we call the pole position model, and it has three temperatures. So he sort of has a high, medium, and low. He can select just by flipping a switch.
Cool. Makes it a little easier, tire warmers, for the guy that doesn't have a big data acquisition team going on. So, interesting.
Yeah, and for a lot of the guys, that's really adequate. I mean, we've done a lot of work when we talk to the tire engineers. Obviously, we're there to learn. But it's interesting to see that sometimes they're looking at the data that we've obtained, because we've worked hard to look at a tire that comes off the racetrack hot and to take that tire either off the rim to check the temperature inside the tire's airspace, or perhaps we've done it with other ways where we've removed the valve stem and you send a thermocouple down inside. And that's what we want to see. What's the difference between the surface of the tire, the carcass with a tire probe from the outside, and the inside of the carcass? And when we see that difference of maybe 25 degrees Fahrenheit, we want to achieve that same difference, meaning the tire is fully stable on the tire warmer, and get that thing fully heat soaked. And that's why having a good insulation is really important.
Okay, cool. All right, and then let's see. Oh, here's one last question. Going back, we're jumping around a little bit, but this is fun. You mentioned in one of these articles talking about nitrogen in place of air, and using tire drying equipment. And this has been a topic that we've talked about a little bit before. And what's kind of your experience on that whole sort of subject of using gases other than just straight, human breathing air to fill your tires with?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's really, you see it hotly debated, people putting nitrogen in the tires. And we've done the same for our own race team. I mean, most of the atmosphere that we breathe is nitrogen. So it's not that the nitrogen that you put in the tires from a tank is anything so special, other than that it's dry, meaning it has a low moisture content in it. You wouldn't want to blow from an air compressor. I'm sure you've seen an air compressor blowing that was dripping out drips of water, and you really don't want to blow that into your tire, because what you're trying to do is to obtain a predictable rise in tire pressure, meaning if you go from 75 Fahrenheit to 175, you're expecting to go from 30 to 36 in tire pressure. you wouldn't want to all of a sudden introduce a whole bunch of water vapor inside the tire that would then go ahead and throw your prediction off. And that's really the only reason to use the nitrogen, is that it's a more consistent product. It's a more consistent gas. You know that it's got a very low or no water vapor content in it. We've seen the tire drying machines that pump and circulate the gas inside the tire in an effort to make it as dry as possible. But honestly, I think that a lot of that's a little bit of a waste, because if you do check the tire for the amount of moisture in the airspace and then go out and run out on the racetrack and come back in, you'll see that number will climb because, you know, the tire, again, it's not a rock. There is moisture in the tire as well. Hmm. And if you've set your hot tire pressure, if you know what temperature you're going to be at on the track, and you've set that pressure with the warmer, you're not going to have any appreciable rise in temperature or pressure as long as you are close to what you set the tire warmer at, you know, based on your testing or what you'd looked at, you know, from your experience.
Okay. Interesting. Cool. And another topic that you mentioned in this article is that a tire at its proper hot pressure will work the suspension properly, the suspension on the motorcycle. And let's talk about that a little bit. What do you mean if a tire's not at the proper temperature, what's sort of going to be happening to the suspension so that it's not working properly? Why would this be?
Well, you know, your tire is truly your first damper or your first piece of suspension. You know, if you're driving and you hit a bump, or you get on the brakes very hard, the first thing that's going to be affected and have a spring rate to it is the tire. And if the tire is, again, I keep using this example of 30 pounds at a cold pressure, it's going to get squished a heck of a lot more than if it was at 36 pounds. And by having that tire basically underinflated, because you don't have it warm, it's not going to feel and work the same as it would if it was at the proper race pressure, where it's going to be later there in the race. And obviously your suspension and everything else that you have set up is set up to work with that tire at its proper pressure. So that if you go out with a tire that's unheated and it's not only doesn't have the grip that you might expect it to, and it's not going to be as compliant and as easy to move on its sidewalls because it's not warm yet, and also it's a little bit underinflated, the whole feel is very, very different. Have you ever heard of a seven-post shaker rig?
No.
This is basically where they put a car on a device that shakes it to evaluate its suspension. And we've built tire warmers for some very advanced car racing teams because they want to do the testing with the tires warm, because that's going to be you know, part of the equation, is that the tires are also one of your suspension components, basically. I mean, imagine trying to drive on the tire and it was at 65 pounds of pressure. It would be ridiculous. It would never work. It would be so far off. Or on the other side, if you had it at 10 pounds, you couldn't go through a race on a 10-pound tire.
Right. Your suspension it's similar, you know, just like, I understand that, you know, having a suspension too soft and the tire's too soft, and it's reacting differently than you expect it to.
Yeah, exactly. The new Dunlop tires, interestingly enough, this new NT tire that Dunlop's coming out with, it's very, very sensitive to pressure, and you do see a trend in a lot of the tire manufacturers to run low-pressure tires. This Dunlop tire needs to be on the track hot at 23 pounds. Now, that's really low. You know, years ago, everything was set at, you know, 29 to 31 cold, and then it would gain 5 or 6 pounds out on the racetrack. Well, this tire wants to be on the racetrack at 23 pounds hot. Again, that's only for the rear. But a lot of these tires are like that. The new Power Race Michelins are also a tire that you, although not as extreme, you start that tire out somewhere around 22 pounds cold. So a lot of these tires now, the direction of technology has been to run these very low-pressure tires, but they're that much more sensitive to being at the proper pressure when they're out on the racetrack.
Right. And you've been working with tires long enough to have seen the evolution that, and I've said it on this show before, a lot of people have said it's not like it's my original thought, but that the street tire that you can go buy today that's just a straight out street tire is as good as the race tire of, you know, like 10, 12 years ago. Are you seeing this constant evolution all across the board that the you know, the race tires are exponentially better than the old race tires, and that street tires are as good as old race tires, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't know if it's just one of these things that happens to you when you become an old codger and you say, I remember when. But you hear, honestly, you hear the guys like Kevin Schwantz riding bone stock street bikes, and they're amazed at how well they work compared to the race bikes that they had, you know, 15 years ago. And you're right, the tires are no different. The technology in tires in the last 15 years, since we've been paying attention to it, has been really fantastic. People pay attention to the motorcycles and the shootouts and the horsepower and the weight, and they're very quantifiable for people to see that a 600 today weighs so little and makes so much horsepower, and they can see that there's been progress. The tires, I think, get overlooked, but they're still black and they're still round, and they don't really think they're so different. But it's really come a long way. It's been a dramatic increase in performance, and I think one of the reasons, you know, lap times keep moving the way they do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they are amazing, the tires that you get now, regular old street tires.
Yeah, you know, if I could leave one last parting word to the listeners, especially people who are involved in track days or involved in racing themselves, as you said early on, tires and suspension are two places to lend your attention, because even though someone might be able to, you know, port your cylinder head and you don't have to know about that, tires and suspension are something that you have to deal with as a rider or racer, seat of the pants, day in and day out. And not to educate yourself about that really hurts you. If these guys just start taking a notebook and taking a look at what their tires look like, what they feel like, you know, do they do good lap times? Are they comfortable on the tires? Start checking their hot tire pressures when they come off the track. And that's one of the things that's nice. A hot tire pressure, you don't need to have a crew. You could put the bike on the stand and take your helmet off and check the pressure. It's not going to change that dramatically in, you know, 120 seconds that you didn't get an accurate reading. And this way these guys can start to educate themselves. What was the hot pressure I was running at? What did the tire look like, you know, just visually? And how did it feel? And if they start paying attention to that little by little, it won't take them too long to get an idea and a better feeling of what's working for them.
Exactly. And, okay, one more question. Now that you mentioned that, ballpark, again, very ballpark, just for the novice intermediate track day guy. If you're taking hot tire temperatures, pressure readings and all of that sort of thing, what's kind of an acceptable safety range for you to do some experiments? If it's like, well, it felt like that when it was at 36, let me try it at, you know, 34, or, you know, is 2 degree or two PSI or 4 PSI, or is there a ballpark that you would recommend? What would you recommend for that?
You wouldn't want to make a dramatic change. You know, you honestly, 1 pound can be a change. For me, as a club racer who's won some national championships, I can notice a pound. If another guy wants to move 2 pounds, that might be okay, but I wouldn't recommend going more than that at a single time.
Okay.
You know, I certainly wouldn't change more than a couple of pounds before trying the bike again and seeing how it feels. Then they'll start to understand. I mean, if you always set your tire at the same cold pressure and then put on your warmers and then go out, when you come back in, if that tire is one day it's at 35 pounds and the next day it's at 37 pounds, the only difference is because the tire is hotter. You know, that's the difference. The difference is the tire is hotter and the pressure keeps going up. It's a direct proportional relationship to the temperature of the tire. And they can start to get an idea of how that tire is working at different pressures at different tracks for that tire that they're running. And they'll just get a little bit better idea of what's going on. Because when they come in and go, boy, I was sliding all over the place, I don't know what's going on, well, you know, take a minute and look at the tire. How does it look compared to how it normally looks? Start looking at it all the time and start checking your hot pressures. And little by little, they'll educate themselves that they're not always running to the tire guy for the answer. They'll start to get a little bit educated on their own.
Yeah, cool. And I understand that. Now, the tire guy, though, is a good place to start, is he not?
Absolutely. You know, your tire guy, if he's experienced, he's changed a lot of tires. So he's seen a lot of tires with both good wear patterns and bad ones. And sometimes they can look at the tire and see that there's a suspension problem, that the guy has a rebound problem in suspension just from the wear pattern of the tire. But, you know, just like anything else, not all doctors aren't good, and not all tire guys are good. So if you have somebody that you work with that you like, you're better off trying to get his information over and over than bouncing around between five different guys as you travel around the country going racing.
Sure, right. Plus also the track day, you always have the other guys there and all of that sort of thing. There's always a lot of good information, a lot of good knowledge to be passed down at a situation like that. It's been super educational and a real pleasure having you on the show, David. I do appreciate the call, and it's just been a lot of fun. I always like talking about tires here on MotoGPOD, and we appreciate your insight and your knowledge, so it's been great.
Yep, I appreciate it being on, and thanks a lot, Bob.
No problem. As you may or may not know, I always talk to my guests a little bit after we kind of say goodbye, and in the sort of chit-chat that David and I were doing, we talked about doing a contest. So here is the blurb about that, which I just couldn't find a way to edit neatly into the show, so I'm just going to tack it right onto the call. I think you're going to like it a lot. David and I were talking a little bit, and we've decided that David has decided very, very graciously to do a really, really cool contest. So what we're going to do is you got to go to chickenhawkracing.com and sign up there on the contact list. And where you're filling out your address, your street address, put MotoGPOD in the line 2 section. And that way, David will know that you're signing up for the contest. If you need help or something with this, give me an email, bob@mojopo.com, and I'll let you know. But David, why don't you tell them what we're going to be giving away here, and then we'll give a little bit more details.
Yeah, one of the things we thought would be neat is we have a set of tire warmers that was used by Ben Spies out at Laguna Seca when he wrapped up his second championship this past year, 2007. These are a set of blue tire warmers, and they're silkscreened with Yoshimura Suzuki, and they also have a number plate on them, a little number plate that says number 11 Spies. And these are perfectly good tire warmers, and they have obviously Ben's been using them, but they're something that we'll be glad to go ahead and give out to the contest winner. And as you said, they just simply have to go to chickenhawkracing.com, register as a new user, and in that address line 2, put in MotoGPOD, and we'll pick someone at random.
Right on. That's a really cool prize, because if you maybe don't have a necessity for a set of tire warmers, you've still got a really cool prize that, these are the set that Ben Spies used. So it's just like getting, like Nikki Hayden's knee puck or something. It's like, realistically, who needs that? But this is also a prize that could be very, very useful. That's kind of cool. So we're going to say go between now, which is February 15th, and March 3rd. So you got there, that's 2+ weeks. And to go to chickenhawkracing.com, sign up there for the contact list. That'll put you into the contest. And David and I will do a quick call, and we'll have it announced on the show that goes up on Friday, March 7th. And we'll announce the winner of that really cool set of tire warmers from Ben Spies. So I think that's awesome stuff. Thanks a lot, David.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good luck to everyone out there.
Right on. All right. Thanks very much for downloading the show. I hope you enjoyed that call with David Podolsky. Thanks very much, David. That was super interesting, informative stuff. I thought it was great. And don't forget about that contest. Go to David's website at chickenhawkracing.com and sign up for his list there. Put MotoGPOD in your address line 2, and he's going to collect all the names together, pick one at random, and you're going to win Ben Spies' tire warmers. I mean, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool gift, I think. You're going to be quality tire warmers, and if nothing else, even if you don't need tire warmers, if you have the fact that they are Ben Spies', so that's pretty cool stuff. And again, thanks to Joseph Saleo for donating to MotoGPOD, and thanks to everyone who sent me an email. I do appreciate it a lot. Thank you very much, guys. The email address is bob@MotoGPOD. If you'd like to send an email to Jules, who shows up on the show an awful lot, he is popmonkey, P-O-P, monkey, @MotoGPOD.com. And if you want to send an email to all of us, me, myself, Jules, and Jim Race, it's MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. All right, enough of the emails and thank yous and all that good stuff. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that my son is down in boot camp and that I've heard from him and all that good stuff. And I just, motorcycle talk is over. So if you're not interested in the military kind of thing, you can tune out. But if you want to hear a little update on my son, what he's doing, because I have to admit, I'm extremely proud of him. My son is down there in Marine Corps boot camp. He's in his third week. And today he did, I think it was circuit training, they called, or something along those lines. It looked like, monkey bars and all that kind of good stuff on the little sort of training matrix they had. So he's having I'm sure he's having a very tough time down there, but he the letters that I've received from him don't sound all sad or anything, so he's probably getting along okay. We got a form letter that said, you know, "Dear blank, I am okay, and my senior drill instructor will take care of me, and please don't send me any pornography or liquor," and all that sort of thing. And then we received a couple of actual, you know, short notes from him. My ex-wife got one that said he loves the food, oddly enough, and detailed some of the calories he's intaking. And then I got one where he told me a few things and then also asked for some stamps. So my son's down there, and like I said, I am proud of him. He's doing something that, quite frankly, I'm not 100% sure I would have had the nads to do when I was 18 years old, and that's go through Marine Corps boot camp. It is tough. It is difficult. Being in the Navy, I have a natural sort of thing about the Marines, and I have a lot of Marine jokes, and if you're interested in any of them, I can share them with you, but the Marines are, it's a pretty cool deal. And actually, you know, why don't we go ahead and close this show with a joke, and this little jest, don't get all butthurt or anything about that, this is just a small jest, and it's not even towards the Marines this time. This one's actually about the Air Force, but we're all brothers, but one of the things that brothers do is sort of argue and fight amongst themselves, and the various services do have their rivalries. So to close out this show, I'm going to talk about the word secure. And if you were to tell the Navy to secure a building, we would go through and we'd lock all the doors and we'd close all the windows and we'd turn off all the lights and pretty much leave it there and that building is secured. If you tell the Army, almost screwed up the joke, didn't I? If you tell the Army to secure a building, they're going to go ahead and they're going to set a perimeter and they're going to make sure that nobody even gets close to that building and that it's going to be pretty secure and all that because you've got guards on it and you're watching and there's a roving patrol and all that sort of thing. You tell the Marines to secure a building, they're going to go in, they're going to kick in the doors, they're going to break all the windows, they're going to shoot holes in all the walls, and they're going to make sure that anything living thing in that building is no longer living and it is dead, and that building is now secure. If you tell the Air Force to secure a building, they will get a 4-year lease with an option to buy. So if you're in the Air Force and you're butt of that particular joke, which probably isn't very funny if you're not in the military, don't worry about it. You know, it's like I said, it's a joke. And so we, you know, we in the Navy, we are the butt of many, many jokes, including why is your name on your butt when you're in the Navy? And speaking of names on butts and pants and things like that, do you know why sailors have the flap, the 13-button flap pants? And that large flap that folds down on your 13-button pants when you're in the Navy, that's a Marine Corps bib. So we're going to leave it off of that, and no more jokes, no more military stuff. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much, and thanks very much for listening through all this thing and me going on about my son and how proud I am of him and all that sort of thing. And until next week, we are out. One thing that you can always count on about MotoGPOD is that there will be the little disclaimer at the end, and that I'll try to make it slightly less boring by maybe trying to make it funny. Whether or not it's funny is entirely up to the listener. However, please bear with me when I tell you that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD.com is not affiliated with any of them. I actually threw in another extra .com. I was just going to say MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them, but because I'm sort of reading this and rambling on and on, got .com kind of thrown in there. So this you could listen to over and over again if you wanted to go to sleep, because it's a little bit of lawyerese that we throw in here at the end of the show to say that MotoGPOD is produced by me and that Dorna doesn't sort of even acknowledge my existence.